You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I'm Jim Collins. I run the Russia-Eurasia program here at Carnegie Endowment, and I'm very pleased to see everyone this morning at a bright and early hour. Our topic this morning for a very distinguished panel is Armenia and Turkey prospects for normalization. I would submit a few years ago that probably wouldn't have been the title, but at least we are thinking in terms that are constructive. Part of the reason for this session this morning is that my colleague Tom DeWall has just done a very updated version of this policy brief from Carnegie, Armenia and Turkey Bridging the Gap. It reflects an updated version of a paper put out some 6 months ago, roughly. And its update is based on an extensive round of discussions that Tom has had with the various participants in the effort to find ways to bridge the gap between Armenia and Turkey. The panel this morning is made up of first my colleague Tom DeWall, who will begin. Tom is a distinguished expert, scholar, and writer on the South Caucasus and on the region. He's just issued a new book, which I commend to you, called The Caucasus, published by Oxford University Press, and it's a very solid introduction to the subject. It's the kind of thing you recommend to a colleague who doesn't know anything about the region to get a very quick understanding of it. Emil Sanamyan, well known, I think, to this audience and to people in Washington, is a journalist and works for the Armenian Reporter. And a former colleague at State Department, Ross Wilson, formerly ambassador in Turkey and now at the Atlantic Council, working as the sort of chief organizer of their Eurasia initiative. I'm going to start this morning with Tom. We'll then go to Emil and Ross for their comments, and then we will open this up for a discussion with the audience. One technical point, if you have a BlackBerry, please turn it off. It interferes with microphones and so forth. So without further ado, Tom, let me give the floor to you to begin.
Thanks very much, Jim. Very good to see you all this morning. There may be a slight feeling of deja vu for some of you who were here 6 months ago when we presented a first version of this paper. But although the paper which you now hold bears the same title, it's been substantially changed. At that point, 6 months ago, we were the focus was on trying to rescue the protocols process, which finally stalled on April 22nd. Now we decided to, 6 months on, to have another meeting on the anniversary, which will be October the 10th, of the signing of the protocols in Zurich, with a slightly, I think, a kind of broader perspective, looking at what can be done, less, I think, looking back and more looking forward about Armenia-Turkey relations. But obviously, we do also want to talk about the protocols and how they could be revived. And so let me just start by a few words about the protocols and remind you all really how much of a surprise really they came October the 10th last year, that signing ceremony in Zurich. Very few people, I think, believed that such a dramatic step was possible. They were really a very big step forward. And I would contend the most positive thing really that had happened to the in the South Caucasus, for the South Caucasus, probably in a decade, where most of the news had really always been negative about failures to agree, and suddenly Armenia and Turkey signing these two protocols with the important caveat that they were to be ratified by the two parliaments, which gave the politicians' political cover to sign them and also spin themselves out a bit of time. I think the most important thing to say about the protocols is it's important what's not in them rather than what's in them. And what's not in them is any mention of the genocide or 1915 and any mention of Karabakh. And that was clearly an agreement by the two sides that the way to make progress was to leave those two issues outside the normalization process. Although, of course, the subcommission on the historical dimension in the protocols was a way of looking at the genocide 1915 issue in a more indirect way. Another point to make to you is there's a misconception that this process was run by the United States. It wasn't. It was a Swiss process. The Swiss basically convened the two parties at their request in, I believe, 2007. And the United States got involved only really basically in early 2009. So we should bear that in mind that it's actually the Swiss, and we have a Swiss diplomat here today, should take credit for being the mediators in this process. The United States, obviously, in its dynamic way, when it got involved in 2009, became one of the leaders of this process. But the design and the format of the negotiations was Swiss. Now, I do believe that the protocols are basically a good product, the best product that could be come up with. I think the problem really was in the marketing. And in particular, I think in retrospect, I would say that the biggest failure was to market the protocols to Azerbaijan, to say the US and Azerbaijan, for other reasons, have had a troubled relationship in the last 2 years, and there was a strong perception in Baku that this was a deal being done behind their backs to exclude Azerbaijan. Now, I believe that, in fact, these protocols, this process, would be good for Azerbaijan, but I don't think the case was made, the argument was made, and Azerbaijan basically became the spoiler of this process, lobbying very hard in Baku to have an explicit link to Karabakh, and the Turks then drew back. Why do I think this would be good for Azerbaijan? Well, clearly, on a symbolic level, if the Armenia-Turkey border were to open, it would look bad for Azerbaijan. It would look like a defeat. The border was closed in April 1993, explicitly because Turkey expressed solidarity with Azerbaijan because of the capture of the Kelbajar region during the war in Karabakh, the Azerbaijani Kelbajar region. But 17 years on, did this closure of the border make any difference? Did it exert any leverage on the Armenians? No, I think the opposite. I think it made the Armenian side more intransigent. It reinforced the Armenian narrative that we are a nation under siege by Turks on two sides. And I think the only way for that narrative to change is for Armenia to open up, Armenia to take a step forward, and for if the Turkey-Armenia border opens, then I think Armenia opens up, it's less a nation under siege, its mentality begins to change. Turkey also enters the South Caucasus as a regional player with much more leverage, as a neutral player. And it's not going to happen overnight, but basically I think this is very helpful for the Karabakh dispute and for Azerbaijan. I don't believe that argument was made to Azerbaijan, and I think that was a failure of marketing of the protocols. We are where we are. The process was suspended in April, because the major reason being that the Turkish side started making explicit linkage to Karabakh, which was not in the protocols. But I don't believe it's completely lost. Clearly, when you talk to Turkish officials, the main message that they have is Turkey finds it hard to do more than one thing at once. At the moment, we've got about a dozen things to deal with in Turkey, much more pressing issues, constitutional reform, the Kurdish issue, the Middle East, So Turkey's the Turkish government is currently fighting a number of battles, but they do say that this could be revived after the election, and that is, and this is quite obviously big, if the AKP wins a majority in the next election in Turkey, which we expect probably about May next year. But that's no reason just to sort of sit back and wait. I think there are many things that can be done in the meantime. And I think the most positive thing to highlight is that the Turkey of today is very different from the Turkey of 10 or even 5 years ago. This year, a number of very remarkable events, April the 24th, Armenian Genocide Day, being marked in Taksim Square in Istanbul, Turkey's sort of busiest public space. The police had explicitly been informed and were there to keep order for a peaceful demonstration on Armenian Genocide Day. A conference in Ankara on the same day looking at these issues. When I was in Turkey back in May, there were, I think, three Armenian-Turkish initiatives going on at the same time. There's an Armenian-Turkish youth orchestra has been formed. So I think very many positive things. I think the genie is out of the bottle, that Turks are beginning to discuss the issue of whatever happened to those 2 million Armenians that used to live in eastern Anatolia up until 1915. That issue is now being discussed in Turkey, in the newspapers, on television. Clearly, there's a long way to go. Clearly, there are many people who are pushing back. But the genie is very much out of the bottle on this issue. Turkey is changing. And this is part of a broader change about Turkey, I think, moving on from the Kemalist tradition, confronting its minorities, confronting the Kurdish issue as well. So I don't think this is a process. It could slow down if there's a different government, but I don't think it's a process that will go into reverse. Having said that, there's a need, much better need, to coordinate activities. September the 19th, there was what could have been a very significant landmark event, which unfortunately went rather wrong at the Armenian church in Akhtamar on Lake Van, the first service, religious service there being held for 95 years, priests from the Armenian Patriarchate from Istanbul being there. But because of a failure to coordinate and a failure as the Armenian Catholicosate in Armenia itself, in Etchmiadzin, had asked to put a cross back on the roof. Armenian officials and other church officials didn't go to that event. And it became involved in, unfortunately, it became a kind of object of political wrangling rather than the purely symbolic, positive event it should have been. But again, let's put that in perspective. Even to have discussed this a couple of years ago would have been unthinkable in Turkey. The fact that Turkey allowed this service to go forward was a very unusual and positive step. And August the 15th, there was a parallel Greek service at Sumala, the monastery behind Trabzon, and that was a big, big success. Lots and lots of Greek politicians and church people there, apparently a very moving occasion. So there's an interesting contrast there between Greek-Turkish and Armenian-Turkish relations. Clearly, Armenian-Turkish relations are a lot more difficult for various reasons, but still they're catching up. Just a couple of words to finish about the kind of what I call the April the 24th issue. I do think that the United States does have a positive role to play here, but every April the 24th that comes around, there's a kind of month of agony where everyone gets stuck on the use of the genocide word in various resolutions, and what's the president going to say? And I think we've maybe 10, 15 years ago, these kind of resolutions may have had some positive effect in exerting pressure on Turkey. I don't believe that's the case now. I think there's a new Turkey to deal with. I think this April 24 thing has become all about process, all about the pursuit of the one word genocide, rather than actually confronting the much bigger issue of what happened to the Armenians of eastern Anatolia in 1915, and Turkey confronting its past and about normalization between the two countries. Which is why at the end of my paper I make the point that there is a goal, there is a destination, by which to set full normalization. I think diplomatic normalization could come earlier, but full normalization between Armenia and Turkey, and that's 2015, the centenary of the Great Catastrophe, as the Armenians call it. And I think outsiders should concentrate on trying to include, to set that as the goal, and to sort of aim to include the Turks in that centenary. That should be the goal, to say this anniversary is coming up and we want you to be part of it, which would give Turkey less than 5 years now, but to come up with a much better official position where they can be inside that centenary rather than outside it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Emil, let me give you the floor next for your thoughts. And
Thank you, Ambassador. I wanted to make a few observations about the normalization process as it's typically referred to, some of the contradictions that it involves, and as well as what is really changing in this relationship, in this process. I would posit that normalization and the focus has been in diplomatic relations on opening the ground border. Normalization is much more than that, and maybe even not so much that. From the perspective of public interest, having embassies in Ankara and Yerevan, obviously they wouldn't hurt, but they're not really practical in terms of what public is interested in. Public is interested in unimpeded travel. Public is interested in economic growth and jobs. All of those issues are being addressed in parallel to the current situation, and not necessarily as part of this process. Normalization is really about reestablishing, or really establishing, a modicum of mutual respect between Armenians and Turks. I think Armenians, generally, the sense is they want stop to victimization of Armenians, be that through denial of the genocide, through the policies that the governments in the past have pursued. And the Turks want the end to the campaign of being maligned or targeted in their eyes with the genocide resolutions. How do they, the Armenians and Turks, find that reconciliation? Is unclear at this point, considering that there is very little pushing, very little momentum pushing the two nations towards a reconciliation. In terms of the specifically the protocols, I felt that from the get-go that there was an effort by both sides, but primarily by the Turkish side, to find an escape clause from the protocols, and the way they were structured, the way the ratification, basically everything hinged on the ratification of the protocols, meant that they really were looking for an escape clause, and they obviously exploited it at the end. This doesn't mean that the protocols are dead as a document. Obviously, both sides have said that they're still somewhere, maybe not on the table, but near the table. But again, the way the document was structured, it was not a straightforward approach by the two sides to find an accommodation, but a document that reflected the mutual suspicions and mutual concerns, and also sort of overlooked some of the mutual differences that the countries have. The biggest contradiction or biggest contrast between Armenia and Turkey, obviously, is the power and influence of each. Turkey is a powerful player and is becoming perhaps a more powerful player in the world. Armenia has a very modest resources, and it can only counter Turkish arguments, policy arguments, with third-party involvement. So if you take away Russian security umbrella, if you take away American diplomatic effort, there's very little left that provides Turkey with immediate impetus to act on Armenia. In that sense, I also disagree with Tom on the resolutions. Resolutions continue to focus Turkey on Armenia. Not necessarily in a positive way always, but they continue to focus Turkey on Armenia and have created, in the past, have created opportunities for those forces in Turkey who are, for whatever reason, are interested in normalization with Armenia, with Armenians, to focus the country's policies on Armenia, which is not necessarily always on the top of Turkey's agenda. What we see changing inside Turkey is clearly a more democratic discourse inside the country. The citizens are much more open to question their government on a variety of issues. Citizens are looking at the Armenian issue as reflecting something profound about what Turkey is and what Turkey was and what where Turkey is going. So that is changing. What is really changing also is how Turkey is interacting with the United States, how Turkey is interacting with other countries of the world. That means that U.S. is in a less favorable position in terms of ability to influence Turkey, or even on such priority issues for the United States as Iran and Israel, and Armenia being a side issue is not always there and on the agenda at all. So what U.S. and the others can do is to both facilitate this process that is ongoing on a public level between Armenia and Turkey, but at the same time, the thinking that has prevailed in the past that U.S. would be able to convince Turkey to change its policy in Armenia is, I don't think, at this point, really a valid argument. It's hard to expect that. So continue to remind Turkey about the Armenian issue, including through the resolutions, and continue to facilitate the public level discussions and processes that do add the positive aspects to the relationship that has been highly negative. The really historic gestures for the Armenian Church in Akhtamar, the April 24th commemoration in Ankara and in Istanbul, which Tom already mentioned, have provided a very important signal, I think, to Armenians. But that's not a one-time affair, and there's got to be a continuation there to fill the relationship with a more positive impetus.
Okay, Emil, thank you very much. Ross, we have your perspective.
Good. Well, thank you, Jim. Thank you, Tom. Thanks especially for the opportunity to go last, because it means that a lot of things I don't have to say. Others have already done that. What I thought I would do is really two things. First of all, talk a little bit about the normalization package and take it apart a little bit. And second, give some thoughts about possible ways forward. I should say everything I say reflects my own personal views and perceptions of what was going on. Turkish, Armenian, Swiss officials should speak to what they think they were actually doing or trying to do at the time. But this is kind of what I perceived. In late November 2007, we were informed about the talks that had been going on for a number of weeks between Turkey and Armenia with Swiss assistance. Turkey and Armenia, had sort of deputy minister level or at some points just below that level, conversations ongoing for a long period of time, and this, in a sense, was an outgrowth of that, coalesced and brought together, of course, as Tom noted, by the Swiss. Why? Because I think it's an important issue. It's hard to get to know, to get inside that topic without really talking to some of the particular players who were involved in it. It was not, as Tom noted, to answer that question, it was not because of something we did. It was not at our initiative. It was not responding, I don't believe, really to U.S. pressure to deal with this topic. It was the initiative of both sides. And I think for different reasons, my perception is that both leaders in both countries decided they want to try to change the paradigm. For Turkey, of course, part of the backdrop is changing the paradigm after the House Foreign Affairs Committee voted in the fall of 2006 to approve the Armenian Genocide Resolution. But I think it was really kind of more than that. The changes in public attitudes in Turkey on issues of history go back quite a ways. Certainly 2004, 2005, you had the beginnings of a much different kind of debate about Turkish history on a variety of fronts, including this one. And I think that there were senior people who wanted to take advantage of that, who wanted to push that forward, who believed that it was good for Turkey, and wanted to use that to change the paradigm in terms of how Turkey approaches Armenia, how Turkey approaches the South Caucasus, how Turkey approaches its own past. Others can probably talk about how that paradigm shift works in Armenia, but I think it ends up kind of being a mirror image of that, a view among some, at least in the Armenian government hierarchy, that maybe there was an opportunity here to change the situation in which Armenia finds itself vis-a-vis its most powerful and most important neighbor with which it's been estranged for so very long. I think an additional aspect kind of flows from the first is a Turkish view that they were not sufficiently involved in the Caucasus, that they were not going to be sufficiently involved in the Caucasus unless and until there's a normal relationship with all three countries. And as I recall, in the sort of spring-summer period of 2007, there was one of the periodic hopeful phases on the Nagorno-Karabakh peace process. So maybe there could be a confluence of things, some progress bilaterally, some progress on the NK problem, that might reinforce one another and help take the region in a different direction. And then you have the whole sort of ethic of, or maybe ethic isn't the right word, the idea behind Turkey's, the AKP government's foreign policy, zero problems on its border. Well, there's one border with which there's still a big problem. And so Turkey's initiative there fit that picture. And then there may also have been personal factors. And here I think, you know, how and why the Swiss got involved may have a little bit to do with that. It was clear that to me that senior officials in both countries, and this is from my conversations with both sides, wanted to find a way out of the situation in which they found themselves, saw an opportunity to do that, based on a number of different things going on, both internally and in terms of the NK, the separate but not unconnected NK issue, and wanted to try to develop something. Their second, maybe talk a little bit about the variables. Most of you, probably all of you, have read the protocols, read the final texts that were put on the web, you know, X number of months ago. And I think it's important just to note, and I mean refer to this, normalization sort of can be an opaque word. You kind of need to take it apart when diplomats meet across a table and start to parse that word. They have to come up with definitions and come up with goals and come up with specifics. And there are a number of variables that were important. One, obviously, is establishing diplomatic relations, opening embassies. Sort of how is that supposed to work? There's a supporting consular side that I heard from Turkish officials. If we're going to have people go, if we're going to have diplomats in our countries, we're going to have tourists going back and forth, we're going to have business people, there's a consular services kind of regime that sort of has to go along with that, that isn't unimportant, especially as you look at the border. A second variable, mutual recognition of the existing border, important for a variety of reasons. Third is the opening, the question of opening the border and sort of where, how, why, for what purposes, how that will work and what's the regime that sort of manages the border. There's normalization of ties kind of in a literal sense, and here's where the issue of governmental commissions came up to kind of work out the government-to-government piece. You know, really, how are we going to relate to each other? How are we going to push elements along? And then there's the public piece that was clearly not unimportant to both sides, the trade, media, civil society, other kinds of contexts that amount to real normalization as opposed to what governments can do. And here, just as an aside, in an early manifestation of my career, I was very involved in the implementation of the Camp David peace accords between Egypt and Israel. And a constant issue was how to go from sort of having established relations and opened embassies and the literal mechanics of normalization to real normalization. And it was noteworthy to me that, that both sides in this discussion were very focused on this. Then, of course, there's the history element that, that Tom noted. Then there's sort of process, what I would call process variables. What's the timing? What's the sequence? What's the pace? And at least as I observe the discussions, those variables were in some respects at least as important as kind of the substantive pieces, how this was going to unfold, what would be the timing, what would be the sequence, what would come first, what would come second, what would come fourth and fifth and so forth. And perhaps a pejorative way to put it, each side kind of wanting to front load the things that are important to it in the process and backload the things that were a little harder. And each side has kind of a mirror image of what those elements might be. Then there are maybe somewhat lesser important process issues. What's the procedure for unveiling this publicly, for getting signatures on a piece of paper, for getting approval by governments that ultimately results in an agreement that parliaments will ratify? But that too was there were variables there that the parties had to discuss. For the first 6 or 7 months of 2008, it was obvious that to me, from what I could observe, the talks were moving along. At some point, with more agreement than at other points, it would be fair to say that both sides expressed a significant degree of frustration about how the talks were going and what the prospects were and so forth, this issue of what gets front-loaded, what gets back-loaded in the sequence, what's some of the specific wording in these protocols, views that, you know, one side is moving the goalposts or changing its positions or its requirements, its red lines in ways that kind of complicated things. And then, of course, nobody noted this, there, in the middle of that, of all of that, you have a change of government in Armenia that's not unimportant and has kind of a significant effect in how, obviously, it should have had a significant effect in how the government of Armenia looked at this. By August, it was clear, or it was clear to me at least, that the momentum was sort of lagging, late July, August 2008. And I'm not really sure why. Both sides, of course, are very tough bargainers. They've been haggling over rugs and other things for a long time and have a complicated history. And then the Georgia War intervened. And I've said this in a couple of other places. I thought that that kind of re-galvanized the attention of both countries on this. And although I have much less expertise on what happens in these discussions after November 2008 when I left Turkey, it's clear to me or it seems to me at least, that what happened in Georgia, what happened for the South Caucasus at that time, was a big additional impetus to both sides to get this dragged across the finish line. And you just think about the symbolism. President Gül, President Sargsyan stand together at the football stadium in Yerevan, in a sense, symbolically saying, we have a vision of the Caucasus. It's not what just happened in Georgia. And they may disagree a little bit on the origins of those things. But anyway, we have a vision. It's not just what happened. And we're prepared to work on the hardest things that have divided our countries for, you know, 80, 90 years to try to work on that vision together. What went wrong? Here I will plead the lack of firsthand knowledge. I could say when I left, everything was okay. That wouldn't be entirely honest. But I'll give you a couple of things. First, this is always going to be hard. History is history. What's laid out in these protocols is complicated. And as we often say, the devil is in the details, and there weren't a lot of details. If you look carefully at these, it was unclear how a lot of this really, truly, honest to goodness was actually going to work. I think a second factor is once this got in a public domain, it became a lot harder for both sides. And the U.S. factor, I think, particularly plays into it, because as this gets more in the public domain and with the change of administration in the United States, this kind of gets seized upon by, for good reasons, seized upon by people here as something that, you know, maybe we can help these countries resolve or at least partially resolve an extremely difficult part of their history and start to lay out a way to move forward. At the end of the day, that U.S. role may have been a big complication, because then what was at stake was relations with the United States, not relations between Turkey and Armenia, which is where they started out, and I thought was part of the wisdom of their having started out directly with each other, with somebody else as a mediator, and not with a direct U.S. role in the discussions. And then third, you know, looking back on it, the deal quite obviously ended up not being totally politically sustainable in Turkey, and the apparent change of position by the Turkey's prime minister on the connection or the linkage with NK being reflecting, I think, the politics that perhaps proved more complicated than the negotiators had anticipated. Where now? As Tom noted, the process is the protocols and the process is suspended, not renounced, not dead. Both sides periodically have reaffirmed their maybe commitment is not quite exactly the right word, but affirm that this remains on the table. And in fact, I read in the Turkish press, Foreign Minister Davutoglu said words to this effect just within the last couple of weeks. It's the way this has evolved ends up, again, as Tom noted, it's a lot harder, I think, for Armenia, for President Sarkisian. He took some very serious risks. Both sides took risks. Sarkisian, I think, in particular, took some real risks. If this had gone forward, I think there really would have been more room for maneuver for Armenia on Nagorno-Karabakh. I think there would have been more opportunities for Turkey to have played a different kind of role on issues related to that conflict, on other issues related to Armenia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan, and the lack of that additional maneuvering room, I think, for everybody makes things more difficult. And of course, Turkey's these matters in Turkish internal politics now are harder than they looked in 2008. When the two countries started this work in the fall of 2007, Turkey had just had a parliamentary election. They were planning on not having one anytime in the near future for 5 years. One comes up in May or June of next year, and that's a complication, I think, for Turkey. And the NK peace process seems really to be pretty gummed up, at least from what I can observe. Last thought, sort of my thoughts about a way forward. One is, I think, that to the extent, well, at some point, and I gather maybe this has gone on a little bit informally around the edges of various things, the two countries will talk to one another. And I think that is something that we should encourage as quietly as we possibly can. To the extent that this is a U.S.-Turkish issue or a U.S.-Armenia issue, not helpful. The two sides need to kind of work on this and quietly see what might be a basis for going forward. Maybe Switzerland can help. Maybe there's some other party that can help. Second, I think to the extent that both sides can latch on to small things in the interim, the church, the episode at Akdamar has its pluses and minuses. There are some pluses there, and it seemed to me that a number of leaders were trying to grasp onto those. That creates a little bit more space that I think could be taken advantage of once Turkey gets past its elections, although I know Armenia has also got a political calendar as well that will, in all likelihood, at some point complicate things again more. I mean, one thought that I've had is at some point a possible way forward that the parties might look at is something that's a little bit simpler. this, you know, I said this, this ended up being a deal that wasn't entirely sustainable. One could say maybe it was a little top heavy. And something that's simpler, that's a little bit more modest in its ambitions, maybe as an interim set of steps that gets agreed upon, maybe that can lead the way forward. Last thought, you know, in the Americans tend to want things to happen like tomorrow. And so, you know, the Obama administration comes in very hopeful about this. So, you know, we need to get these things signed, and then we need to get them implemented, and we ratified, and then we need to get them implemented. In this part of the world, things move slowly. If there's anything I learned spending 6 years in Turkey and Baku, things move slowly. People have a long perspective. And while that's not much solace for those that and I know there are many of you in the room that have relatives that were very much part of an extremely painful period of history, I think there is a longer-term perspective here. My strong sense is Turkey has that perspective. I expect that Armenia does as well. So it leaves me relatively optimistic that the positive things going on in Turkey and the positive things that went on in these bilateral discussions with the help of the Swiss can be picked up in a year, a couple of years, at some point in the future going forward. Why don't I stop there?
Okay, well, thank you all, each of you, very much. I think it's a discussion with a number of aspects and food for thought, and I'm sure there will be questions and views. I would like, though, to start with the first question, if I can, just using the moderator's prerogative. And that is, to what extent is the Karabakh issue, in a sense, a stopper? Can this go forward without Karabakh at least making parallel progress, if not coming to a resolution? There are very different views about this on the two sides so far. And you've indicated that there are ways in which this could have assisted Karabakh negotiations, and some have suggested, too, that Karabakh negotiations and their status could have assisted this process. But right now, the picture on the Karabakh side is pretty grim, and so the question really is, can this really move forward in the ways that some of your thoughts suggest, absent something going forward on Karabakh?
Let me start on that one. I think we're in a very unfortunate place at the moment, because as long as they were parallel processes, with a clear, you know, a clear relation, that was fine. But once they've been tied together, it makes them both harder. Basically, what's happened is that we've now got a situation where a difficult process, the success of a difficult process, Armenia-Turkey, has now been tied to success in an even more difficult process, Armenia-Azerbaijan. And I don't think that actually helps anyone. And I think even the Azeris recently, from some reports I've had, are also looking around and seeing the situation is rather bleak. The Armenians have the talks are really deadlocked at the moment, and in the summer Armenia signed this new big military agreement with Russia, clearly in response to all the events of the last year. So I would say clearly Azerbaijan has concerns and they need to be taken seriously, but I think it's unrealistic to expect an Armenian president who is in a politically difficult situation, as is Serge Sarkisian, who comes from Karabakh himself, to give up any territory, any occupied, captured territory, in return for Armenia-Turkey normalization. That's simply not going to happen. So I think we have to be, if we're looking for something that Azerbaijan gets out of this, it has to be something different. And my own idea, which I mentioned in this paper and I can flesh out if anyone's more interested, is that it has to be about, it could be about Nakhichevan, it could be about the Azeri exclave of Nakhichevan, which is separated from the rest of Azerbaijan by Armenian territory, which borders Turkey. If a transport communications were to be opened up across the occupied territories from Azerbaijan to Nakhichevan and ultimately to Turkey, Azerbaijan would get something. It would get restoration of transport links to its lost exclave. Armenia would be making a concession which would not involve giving up any land, and Turkey would be able to greet this as a positive move and move forward with normalization. I think that would be a win-win. That's the only thing I can see which, you know, would break this particular deadlock.
Emil, Ross?
I'd like to go back a little bit and just remind everybody, remind myself about it. Turkey refused to establish relations with Armenia before Karabakh War. That needs to be taken into account before Karabakh War expanded, well before any Armenian military success in the Karabakh War. If we go back to 1991, 1992, Turkey already had conditions for relations with Armenia that had nothing to do with Karabakh. They had to do with the genocide issue. They had to do with the bilateral condemnation of the Armenian terrorism that happened in the decades before. So there's a bilateral agenda between Armenia and Turkey, and it preceded Karabakh. So when I hear Turkish officials referring to the Karabakh conflict as the reason they're not ready to move forward in Armenia, I don't necessarily buy it. I feel that it's being used as an excuse in this case. It's not to say that that there are Turkish interests in the Caucasus, there are Turkish interests in the relationship with Azerbaijan, but we have seen Turkey move very rapidly and very aggressively on some of the other issues, be that relations with Greece, overcoming a lot of nationalist objections, relations with Kurdistan, again, Iraqi Kurdistan, overcoming a lot of nationalist objections. So I don't necessarily agree with the notion that people have sort of come to that it was Azerbaijan that stopped this process. I really feel that Turkey acted at whatever it thought it was in its interest in this situation. Now, in terms of linking or not linking the two processes, clearly everything's linked in that part of the world. From Armenia's perspective, I think there is a clear linkage, and the barometer of Turkey's role in the Karabakh conflict, Turkey's relationship with Azerbaijan, is the real barometer of whether Turkey is ready to find a positive accommodation with Armenia. If you see Turkey lean much more in favor of Azerbaijan than it has so far, that is a hugely negative signal in the presence or absence of genocide recognition or commemoration of any kind, which is when it comes to it's not a security matter. It's not a matter at the heart of Armenian interest.
Okay, Ross.
Just as a footnote, I'd say that there are probably a few people in this room that were involved in assisting Turkish efforts to reconcile more fully with Greece in the late 1990s and would be able to speak to how extremely difficult that was. And having been personally involved in Turkey, Northern Iraq discussions as well, I can tell you very, very difficult and not something that was easily done. Either because of the mechanics of the way the two sides relate to each other or because of domestic pressures within Turkey that limit the government's space for maneuver. Maybe to answer your question, Jim, is NK a stopper? Can the process move forward? Well, it obviously was. So I think we can recognize that. I think as I look back on the discussions that I'm familiar with, there was really the issue boiled down to, is there a negative linkage or is there a positive linkage? Negative linkage, there must be progress on NK, or there must be withdrawal of Armenian forces from the territories around it, or there must be something else related to NK specifically, and only then can the process go forward. Negative linkage, what I would call that negative. You must do X and before we can do Y. And positive linkage. We take these steps, it will make it easier and more it'll create space in which there can be progress on these other things. And we need to see those things happen in order to sustain the process. So I think that there were at least some Turks Turkish officials who believed and hoped and expected that by taking this step, it would lead to maybe agreement on basic principles between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which were under discussion at the time, that then can be reinforced by some additional steps between Turkey and Armenia, that then could be reinforced by some steps on the NK track, and you could have a virtuous cycle as opposed to a negative one. To what end was always a little unclear, and in the way you do diplomacy, sometimes you don't want to clarify everything because you might not like the answer. Let things develop a little bit. But what were going to be those things that the positives that would result? Maybe it's basic principles, but I mean that's me talking, not expectations of the parties necessarily. And I think there was a little bit of a problem there. The third thing I think I've felt for a long time that one of the problems that in the Nagorno-Karabakh negotiations. Background problem has been the lack of Armenian government clarity about where they will end up with Turkey as a result of or following a peace deal with Azerbaijan. Maybe I'll go a little bit too far and say at the end of the day, the Republic of Armenia maybe kind of doesn't care that much about its relationship with Azerbaijan. Yes, they'd probably like to have a peace agreement, and yes, they'd like to have normalization of relations, but the real prize is in a different direction. Turkey leads Armenia somewhere else to greater integration with the West, toward a different kind of trading relationship with the rest of the world that doesn't rely on Russia and Armenia. That's what they care about. And the absence of clarity, I know this was the case in the 1990s, the late 1990s, at a couple of different stages in the discussions, and I think it was also a case later, the lack of clarity about where Armenia was going to end up following a peace deal certainly didn't make it any easier for Armenian politicians to make what are obviously extremely difficult compromises. And so, you know, part of the paradigm that I think Turkey, when it initiated this effort, and Armenia as well, the paradigm that they were trying to change was to change that paradigm. To develop some greater degree of certainty about that Turkish-Armenia peace, both in and of itself and in conjunction with steps that might be taken on NK.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Let me now turn to the audience and let people begin the process. Can you wait for a microphone, give your names and who you're affiliated with, and I'll start with John Evans.
John Evans, formerly in Yerevan as U.S. Ambassador. First of all, I want to thank Carnegie and Tom in particular for so much contributing to an enlivenment of the discourse here in Washington about these issues, which were not being fully addressed until you got here, Tom, really. I mean, it was a very dry climate, and now you have really stirred the pot to very good effect, and a lot of useful things were said by everybody today. Rafi Hovhannissian, who was the first foreign minister of the new Republic of Armenia, recounted last year how it was when Armenia went to the OSCE to become a member. I guess it was still the CSCE at that time. And Turkey had conditions for Armenia joining the CSCE, taking its seat. And Rafi said to the Turkish ambassador, look, we can either list all the problems that we have between our two countries and try to go at them, or we can take one step at a time. And after some wrangling and pushing and pressure from the U.S. and others, the Turks relented and allowed Armenia to take its seat at the CSCE. I think that situation still obtains. And I agree with Ross that perhaps the protocols were too ambitious. Almost certainly they were too ambitious. Now, one can question the motives of one side or the other on this, whether it was intentionally too ambitious and these escape clauses were intentionally built in. But you said, Ross, that you thought some smaller steps were in order, and I totally agree with that. The simplest thing, there's been a confusion, in short, between the simple question of normalizing diplomatic relations, which is a very value-free, simple thing to do. It can be done with an exchange of diplomatic notes between two ambassadors. It does not necessarily require embassies in both capitals. Diplomatic relations, Turkey already recognizes the Republic of Armenia. That happened immediately. If I'm not mistaken, Turkey was the first state to do it, unless we were, but it was very early. So Turkey has relations with Greece, despite the multitude of problems. So diplomatic relations do not solve problems, but what they do is allow problems to be discussed in private instead of through megaphones. It seems to me that indeed we are in a worse situation because the protocols failed than we were, despite something of an atmospheric improvement with the football diplomacy and so on. But what I would very much, and we have in the room a representative of the Armenian embassy. I don't know if we have one from the Turkish embassy. I suspect we do. What a simple thing to have a couple of ambassadors somewhere, maybe in Tbilisi, exchange notes. And there is a procedure for registering such, just saying we intend to enter into diplomatic relations. That can be registered with the United Nations. Then you have that channel. And even that would improve the atmosphere. It would show a direction. The larger question of societal reconciliation and dealing with the unresolved question of recognizing the genocide or at least not continuing to deny it, that's a much bigger job. That will take many more years. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Yes, sir, there.
David Gregorian, I'm wearing two hats. I'm with the International Monetary Fund and Policy Forum Armenia. I totally agree with both Emil and Tom that something's definitely happening on the other side of the border. And while I wouldn't put my guards totally down, one has to be blind not to acknowledge that, especially on a societal level, civil society, and also in the government, Turkey has done a lot more to come close to Armenia than sort of on the Armenian side. However, what Ambassador Wilson alluded to is interesting, and I was sort of hoping we'll hear more about it. Once things hit the public domain, things became more difficult. Once the protocol hit the public domain, became more difficult. In fact, any of the three polls that I saw, in any of the polls, there was an overwhelming sort of negative response of the Armenian public towards the protocols. And I wonder whether any of that, and sort of saying that, playing the card that those people are irrational, probably wouldn't be sort of a strong position to take. So I wonder if any of the domestic political problems that Serzh Sarkisian had would contribute to that low level of public buy-in. After all, having sort of instituted himself upon the country as a result of a fraudulent election in 2008, and basically endure with Kocharyan having suffocated the economy for the past few years and bringing it to a rather weak point from the competitiveness point of view to open up the border should play a role in that. After all, you know, trade is not about access. It's always about ability to trade. It's about competitiveness. So I wonder if you care to comment about sort of what are the sources behind this low public buy-in in Armenian context? Thank you.
Tom or Emil or Ross?
Well, certainly the domestic situation and the extent of public dissatisfaction with how the elections went and the political system has developed in Armenia is there. It's reflected on everything that Armenians discuss, everything that Armenians think, and it is reflected in the way the public perceives any government initiative. However, in this case, I think this goes a little bit beyond domestic politics. It's a really essential issue for the Armenians in Armenia, in the diaspora. How do you find an accommodation with Turkey? If Armenia had the most legitimate government in domestic and public eyes, I think those issues would still be on the agenda. You still have people questioning this particular way of moving forward with Turkey. You would still have people supporting this particular way of moving forward with Turkey. So when you had the fallout in Armenia, and I think it was very close to 50-50 in terms of people either being kind of supportive or supportive of the protocols and kind of opposed, very antagonistic towards the protocols, you had, you know, it wasn't the pro-government people went with the government and the anti-government people went with against the government. So it really fell across those party lines, you could say.
Tom? Okay. Mike?
Mike Lemon from the Near East South Asia Center. I'd like to expand on Tom's specific suggestion about using transport linkages as a positive potential, particularly vis-a-vis Azerbaijan and Nakhchivan, and expand that out to build on Ross's paradigm shift concept and say that the paradigm shift to a potential win-win-win approaches is needed not just in Ankara and Yerevan, but also in Baku for very real, very legitimate domestic political reasons in all of those polities. One can recall that some 10 plus years ago, the Trade Development Administration actually did a survey of the existing rail and road linkages between Turkey through Armenia to Azerbaijan, looking at what it might take to repair and update those linkages, particularly through the occupied territories where they had been, the tracks had been literally pulled up. But the whole idea was to try and get out of a zero-sum win-lose paradigm and try and construct a positive alternative vision for each of the countries within a broader region, and having the South Caucasus perhaps once again become this crossroads of trade and commerce, sort of a riff off the old Silk Road concept. Is that it wasn't able to go through at the time, although it did form an important sub-theme within the ongoing negotiations and conversations that did not come to fruition. But is that something within the current context might be a way to get at Ross's paradigm shift, expand that paradigm shift to include Azerbaijan? Because I frankly, personally, am very skeptical that you can limit a Turkey-Armenia relationship bilaterally, strictly. I think the realities politically, regionally, and domestically are that it's got to be part of a larger whole. And this, whether or not it's tied to a specific resolution of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict or a specific outcome, could be something that perhaps early on could be explored, at least in the practical, on-the-ground surveys that some outfit like the TDA is capable of doing. Just thoughts on that.
Okay. Who wants to try this?
I would only say there's a certain what you've talked about is a specific aspect, I think, of what John was referring to. And for me, you know, one of the things when you have a whole set of knotty problems in diplomacy, one of the things you can do is sort of slice and dice them into smaller pieces that kind of end up being a little bit easier to deal with. So normalization of relations, yes, you can sign protocols, you can open embassies, you can actually send diplomats to those embassies, you can send ambassadors to those embassies, you can imbue a bilateral commission with actual work that you know tries to develop trade ties and transport ties and you know air ties, you know, all the normal stuff that countries do. You can slice and dice the border. you know, is it open? You can open it for diplomats. You can open it for civil society. You can open it for, you know, people that have relatives on both sides of the border. Maybe that's not many. You can open it for, and there was some discussion when Akdemir opened a couple of years ago that in Turkey that the authorities should open it so that Armenians could just, instead of going to Istanbul and then flying to Istanbul and coming all the way back, they could just drive across and sort of. So, you know, there, and if you think about almost all the aspects, there are ways to kind of slice and dice it. The specific one you refer to, Mike, I think is pretty hard. In just given where the parties are right now, in the absence of their taking some steps bilaterally and probably some concrete step forward, even if it's not large or final in any significant way on Karabakh, but something that the parties could point to, maybe there's a possibility there. But I think just given the things that have been said now, that will be extremely difficult. Maybe there's some work that could go on to survey, and you know, often there's no harm done in those sorts of things. Expectations do get created, money gets spent, and at least in the present environment, it's not obvious to me that that's going to that will lead to something that we would like to see happen.
That's so many.
Okay.
Hands going up.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you all for your presentations. Kate Nahapetian with the Armenian National Committee of America. I wanted to focus our attention to what was going on right before the protocols were announced, and before April 24th, the first April 24th of President Obama, who had pledged that he would recognize the Armenian genocide and that President Bush's policy on it was, quote, inexcusable. Turkish officials were saying, oh, we think the border will be open very soon. We see a lot of positive developments. This was leading up to April 24th. And the fact that the protocols were announced 2 days before April 24th on April 22nd, I think is something that should be brought to everyone's attention to shed light on really Turkey's sincerity on this. I don't think Azerbaijan was the spoiler. I think Turkey all along had the intention of signing the protocols but then not following through. The reason the protocols were delayed for several hours and that the Armenian foreign minister had to be physically brought to the signing ceremony by Secretary Clinton was because the Turkish foreign minister wanted to talk about Karabakh in his statement. So it was already evident that they always had a plan to link it with Karabakh. The day after they were signed, Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan said, oh, no, we're not going to end our blockade until Karabakh is resolved, reverting back to the position they've had for the past over 16 years. And I think the solution here is not to find a way to have Armenia make more concessions after they've made all these concessions, but to find a way to get Turkey to end their preconditions to normalizing relations. Turkey has established relations with virtually every country that it has relations with without having to need parliamentary approval. I think as long as you need a Turkish parliament to ratify normalizing relations with Armenia, it's not going to happen. And so we should just force Turkey to develop relations like it's done with every other country, which is to sign protocols and agreements to open embassies. It's really that simple. And I think it's really unfortunate that the State Department used to have a policy that these should be ratified without preconditions in a reasonable time frame. Assistant Secretary Gordon at one point said as soon as possible at the Brookings Institute. But now the State Department has said, oh, well, we understand that both parties want more time, so we'll just give you as much time as you need. And that's not true. Armenia doesn't want more time. It's the Turks, the Turkish government, that wants more time. And as long as we're willing to give it to them, we're not going to see any improvement. And I think a really important way of promoting reconciliation is to promote more openness in Turkey to speak about the Armenian genocide openly. It's still a criminal offense. And one Armenian editor who was Turkish paid with his life and was assassinated, and his killers have still not been convicted 3 years after the fact. And I'd like to find out, I guess, what comments you have, and Ambassador Wilson, what was the U.S. Embassy doing to promote more open discussion about the Armenian genocide in Turkey?
Okay, thank you.
Just briefly, four points. Everything that I saw in the negotiations, and we were, emphasize again, we were not party to them, but I had conversations, obviously, with Turks and with Armenian officials, is both sides were, in that period, November 2007 to November 2008, very sincere. And I think believed that the other side was sincere in wanting to do the deal along the lines of what ultimately emerged. I think the idea that somebody wanted it to fail is and that's not exactly what you're implying, but I think that would be wrong, at least from everything that I saw. Second, in terms of the timing around April 2009, I'm not actually in a position to comment on it, including because I wasn't involved. I can say there was a lot of urgency to this in the summer and then again in the fall of 2008. Certainly the Turkish officials that I talked to, very anxious to move this forward right now and wanting to get it signed right now. And then at a later point, there's always back and forth in negotiations. At a later point, Armenia wanting to move it forward very, very quickly. And it ended up being April 2009. I don't think that's what either side had in mind, or certainly was not what they were discussing with each other or informing us about in late 2007, 2008. This issue of ratification is a complicated one. And I don't want to get into diplomatic discussions that are not my business to disclose, but I just tell you, it's a lot more complicated, I think, than you have described it. Last, the assassination of Hrant Dink was a wake-up call, and a lot of people regarded it that way. Something's going on here. Again, that's not what we want. Turks saying, many Turks, including in the government, saying, this is not our Turkey. This is not the kind of Turkey we want. Indirectly, I think it gave some impetus to what already was a developing conversation in Turkey about history. And there's a joint statement that was put out last April by a group of intellectuals talking about this. The space has gotten bigger and bigger. The normalization of Turkish-Armenia relations will give that more space, I think. And it's part of a broader set of changes in Turkey that I think, generally speaking, are healthy for Turkish society and the kinds of things that we, that Armenia, that others in the region would like to see.
Just briefly, I mean, there are clearly different tracks here, and what we don't want to see is one track closed down, but just because another track is stuck, and clearly on the societal level, very positive things going on. Disappointing that the political level is stuck, but that doesn't mean that other things can't be done, other things can't be tried. And I think the most important thing that's going on at the moment is Turkey is going to get a new constitution. It's already had this referendum. Prosecutions on 301, Article 301 is still in the statute, but prosecutions are way down. And I think if the AKP gets back in and completes this new constitutional reform next year, 301 will be history, and that whole kind of militarization of Turkish society will start to recede into history.
If I can make a point about what streams of thought there might have been in Turkey before, after the invitation was extended to come to Armenia, for that soccer game, there's got to be at least two streams of thought. One, a conservative, sort of risk-averse, perhaps, or maybe more nationalistic position on the Armenian or on the Armenian offer, and then the positive position, trying to engage and trying to change the dynamic in the relationship, clearly, obviously, is also there. So those two streams of thought must have competed, and what helped the positive overtake the negative, at least for that period of time, 2008, 2009. I do think it was Ambassador Wilson's already mentioned the Georgia conflict really raised Russia, and with it to an extent Armenia, and raised a lot of uncertainties for Turkey in the Caucasus. I think also the ascendancy of the Obama administration, as for a time, lifted the potential or hypothetical opportunities that the Armenian American community had, and also raised uncertainties for Turkey. So those two two things combined, I think, made the argument of the party that was for the engagement in Turkey, more sound, more acceptable to the decision makers.
Okay. Wayne.
Thank you. Wayne Murray, American Foreign Policy Council. I'd like the panel to address the question of what next and what best for the United States in its involvement here. Ross Wilson has implied that sort of the initial Obama administration's enthusiasm and embrace may have been less than helpful. But there are two processes going on here in which the United States is involved in both. On Karabakh, there's bilateral talks between the two sides, always have been, but then there's the Minsk group process, which involves the United States, does not involve Turkey. Then there's the negotiations on the relations between Turkey and Armenia, in which the United States is involved, does not involve the European Union, because Switzerland's not a member, does not involve Russia. And it seems to me by having these two kind of structures of negotiation going on with different memberships, the potential for misunderstanding and mischief is considerable. So where should the United States put its focus, and where may it be most benign, and where should it most appropriately seek to push perhaps other countries to the fore?
Well, three reactions, Wayne. First, Turkey is in the Minsk group. They're not one of the co-chairs, but they're in the Minsk group. Certainly, when some of us were involved with policy related to the NK conflict, the Minsk group co-chairs made a pretty regular effort of visiting Turkey, of consulting with Turkish officials, informing them of what's going on. That degree of engagement has fallen off considerably, and probably is not a particularly helpful thing. I would be on the sort of the EU and you know the Swiss on the one hand, EU on the other. I'd be wary of kind of overcomplicating what's already extremely complicated. I think to the extent that the parties made progress, it was when they were working together in a small room in a nice Swiss city, or actually they met a couple of other places, I think, too. But you know they were together, and there wasn't a lot of chaff around the edges to complicate things. I think our role ought to be to kind of work very quietly behind the scenes, give some encouragement, maybe give some ideas, but come back to something. I repeat something I said earlier. To the extent that this becomes a U.S.-Turkey or a U.S.-Armenia issue, I'm not sure that leads us to leads countries that we care deeply about to where they need to get. They got to figure this out. We can help, but we can't do it and shouldn't do it.
Okay, we're coming close to time, so I want to take two or three questions and let people then respond. Let me start here. And please keep the question short if we can. Yeah.
I'm going to read this. Lev Bagramian, this is for Ambassador Wilson. A few days ago, there were prayers and celebrations held at the crumbling cathedral in Ani. As far as I know, this cathedral is a historic and protected site in Turkey, and one would guess that in order to hold any such large-scale events, one would need permission. What do you think were the motivations behind allowing for such activities, which, as the BBC video showed, were not all religious and included dancing and celebrations?
Okay. Yes. And then I'll come to you.
Thank you. Shafak Mehraliyeva with Azertaj News. Let me just quickly start by thanking Mr. Duval for always opening the discourse on some of the tough questions that countries in the region may not be willing to talk about. I wish we had someone, first of all, on the panel to talk a little bit broadly from the Turkish or Azerbaijani perspective, because I feel like we're missing the whole picture without these important variables. But to follow up on Mr. Duval's statement on that this deal has to be marketed better to the Azerbaijani side, I think there's no question that Azerbaijan considers this issue exclusively from the point of Karabakh and the progress on it. But following up on your statement that you do not believe that President Sarkisian realistically would return compromise an inch of the occupied territory in return to this Armenian-Turkish border. How do you see the arguments presented to Azerbaijani side, you know, for the benefit of Karabakh resolution in the long run, unless it includes the change of government in Yerevan?
Thank okay. you. Yes. Anne, right here, please. No, this the gentleman standing up.
Yeah, he's from
Farhad Mehdiev, Kafkas University. I need to give some data in order not to mislead the audience. And I have to
I need to ask you to confine it to a question, and if you have a very short observation.
The first is that Turkey recognized Armenia before of Nagorno-Karabakh dispute, and Mr. Samanyan told that it closed its borders. And the Turkey closed its border with Armenia after occupation of Kelbecar. We should consider it. And Turkey has a precondition, yes, but some of them is very important because Armenia still have some claims on Turkey lands. You know, they have the independence, they have some claims over Turkey territories around Van and other districts also in Erzurum. And what my question is, we didn't speak about role of Russia here. I can say surely that Armenia doesn't have fully independent foreign policy. I mean, Russia's influence is very strong, and if the care is if the Armenia will have more a close relationship with Turkey, it will decrease the influence of Russia in Caucasus. I think it's wrong approach because you know most of infrastructure. I mean, railroads, energy supplies, part of telecommunication in Armenia, it belongs in possession of Russian companies. And is it just opening borders with Turkey will not decrease the influence of Russia. So why we don't speak here about the role of the Russia in this in the process? Thank you very much.
And one more question. Yes.
Thank you very much. My name is Varjan Ersesyan. I represent Armenian Embassy here in Washington, D.C. There have been pretty many questions. I would like to reflect and understand there are time restrictions. But first of all, on Armenia's intentions and role in this entire process, Armenia initiated, the President Sarkisian initiated this normalization process and inviting President Gül, not from any deriving from any domestic political considerations. I fully agree with Emil Sanamian, but basically from deriving from Armenia's foreign policy priority of normalizing of its, you know, existing relations with its primarily two neighbors. Now, which one would come first, namely Armenia-Turkey normalization or Nagorno-Karabakh peaceful resolution, is a matter of thorough discussion. So the point that Armenia-Turkey normalization came in this instance first doesn't mean that Armenia is not interested in Nagorno-Karabakh peaceful resolution. Just the contrary. Since its independence, since 1994, there have been peaceful negotiations going on within the framework of OSCE, Minsk Group, and Armenia's position on Nagorno-Karabakh conflict has been clear. With or without open border with Turkey, Armenia's position has not changed and will not change ever because it derives on basic and fundamental notion of the right of the people of Nagorno-Karabakh to self-determination. And for the sake of whatever border, Armenia is not going to change its position because it's a fundamental human rights issue and national security matter for the Republic of Armenia. Now, on the role of Azerbaijan, I believe it played rather a destructive role, not only in Nagorno-Karabakh peaceful resolution, unfortunately, by maximizing its positions there and torpedoing and jeopardizing the negotiating process by militaristic statements and, on the other hand, by, you know, maximalist demands. But also, unfortunately, it played a negative role on Armenia-Turkey. Now, the question for Ambassador Wilson, maybe as a prominent Turkey member expert, is that, in your opinion, was this an excuse for Turkey, Azerbaijan's demand to not to ratify, or it was Turkey's itself, Turkey's decision, Turkish government's decision. Again, I have a lot of points to say, but on what Tom suggested about possibility of opening with Nakhichevan, definitely, I mean, this has been the case in the past, and the government of Armenia has unilaterally and unconditionally offered, and I believe the OSCE special representative, if Ambassador Kasparzyk would be here, he would confirmed the fact that the government of Armenia has proposed, right in the aftermath of the Key West talks, to open as a confidence-building measure the northern route to Nakhichevan via Armenian territory, and even we offered to provide the security guarantees for Azerbaijani transport movement upon our territories. Unfortunately, it was the government of Azerbaijan who rejected, because it would be viewed as a confidence building or as an engagement in a regional cooperation with Armenia. So what's next in a couple of words? I believe in the terms of normalization process with Turkey, there is one thing can happen. There cannot be an illusion that there is a process going on. There is nothing going on at this point. The one thing can happen is the ratification. If Turkey has the political will and determination to move forward, one thing can happen. It's the ratification. My government is ready for that process without preconditions. That's the only way my government would be engaged. If in the meanwhile the government of Azerbaijan would demonstrate enough political will and compromise to move forward with the basic principles, let them be our guests. We would be happy to be engaged and resolve the conflict once and for all. But if this conflict is not resolved, we are not going to, for whatever border reason, sacrifice the right of the people of Nagorno-Karabakh to self-determination. Thank you very much.
Let me start with Ross. We'll go to Emil, and then Tom, you can wrap up.
Sure. Asked a question about the events in Ani. I think it demonstrates the diverse nature of Turkish politics and that these are very highly charged political issues. And remain so, and complicate the ability of the government to maneuver on these things. Second, on the role of Russia, there's a little bit of the enigma wrapped in a mystery. I mean, it's hard to see inside what Russian motivations are. It's important. I think it's significant that both Armenia and Turkey, as best I could tell, went to some lengths to inform the Russian government about what they were doing, presumably in the same manner that they did with us. I'm not aware of some nefarious Russian effort to derail this. Why the Turkish government change of position? Basically, you'd have to ask a Turkish official. One of the first things I learned in serving in Turkey is never speak for the Turkish government. I will repeat what I said earlier. The negotiators who worked on this on both sides, obviously I'm more familiar with the Turks, did so in good faith. Politics ultimately kind of overwhelm things, apparently. Parenthetically, I would note the initiative to begin this work with Turkey actually was under the Kacharyan administration in 2007. And last, sort of when we talk about preconditions, just a couple of people referred to this, preconditions for this, preconditions for that. The truth of the matter is, in most negotiations, and I would include this one as well, when one side talks about no preconditions, they mean no, the other side doesn't get to have preconditions. And everybody's got their conditions, and the task of diplomacy is to try to drag everybody forward across the finish line. Hopefully, it'll happen.
Emil,
On the Ani point about Ani, obviously, I had mixed emotions about it. On one hand, it was a sort of a prayer at a cathedral, even though Muslim prayer. I'm for freedom of religion and praying wherever everybody wants to pray. Obviously, the way it's viewed in Armenia is highly negative, and it reiterates the negative stereotypes. The problem we constantly have with Armenia and Turkey is that just Turkey has so many more opportunities to act both positively and negatively towards Armenia, and Armenia just has a difficult time either retaliating or reciprocating. It's hard to imagine Armenian nationalists going praying at a mosque in Yerevan, for example, as a retaliation. I mean, it's just not a part of a discourse. Or while you have restoration of Akhtamar in Turkey, it's hard to find a monument of similar value to the Turks on Armenia's territory to restore as a friendly gesture. So you always have this disconnect between Armenia and Turkey, and Armenia's just been very static in how it stood there with sort of the hand stretched out for about 19 years now and has not been reciprocated. In terms of the role of Russia, I think a relationship between Turkey and Russia in the past several years has really taken off. I don't think there's any other way to look at it. There is so much contact on a high level, so much Russian investment. Russia is the number one trade partner now for Turkey. has taken over from Germany. And clearly, if any role Russia had played in this process, and it's true, the Turks do view Armenia as part of the Russian camp, and that's, it's their right to have a perspective. I think that improvement in the Russian-Turkish relationship has had a tremendous effect on how Turkey was able to deal with Armenia with less suspicion and more more of an open approach.
Okay, wanted to comment on Varajan's statement. It's very positive that the Armenian government has proposed opening up a northern route to Nakhichevan. I'm actually proposing something a bit more difficult for the Armenian side, which is a southern route which goes down along the Iranian border through the occupied territories and Mehri, which I think is the most direct route to Nakhichevan. And to your question about Azerbaijan, well, I guess it's a difficult situation for Azerbaijan, so I just really have to turn the question around and say, what does Azerbaijan get out of the current situation? That there was a perception that Azerbaijan has more leverage because of the closed border, but I don't think that's working for Azerbaijan. In fact, I think it's working the other way around, that Armenia is more intransigent. I think the problem, as Azeris, you have dealing with the Armenians, is that you have a competition of grievances, and the Armenians are not just counting the grievances with Azerbaijan, but counting grievances with Turkey as well, which go back to 1915, and that's obviously a huge, huge thing for the Armenian people. If you begin to take that off the table, if you begin to sort of take the grievances with Turkey off the table, normalize relations, then suddenly it becomes about Turkey recedes into the shadows, and it becomes about Armenia and Azerbaijan, and it becomes, and I think the Azerbaijani case at that point, that our lands are being occupied, that these cities are in ruins, at that point your case becomes much stronger, the Azerbaijani case becomes much stronger, and I think there is a much more momentum behind actually solving the Armenian-Azerbaijani bilateral issues once Turkey is taken off the table.
Okay, I want to thank everybody very much. We have to wrap this up. I appreciate the comments from each and everyone who participated and good questions, and I want to thank the panel for a very good discussion and very great candor. So thank you all very much.